on wire legs, flamingos on springs, and ducks with plastic wings that circled when the wind blew. A forgotten cardboard Christmas reindeer sat soggy in the front garden, which was mostly mud, baby fuzz patches of grass poking through intermittently. I turned off the car, and we both stared into the yard with its jittering denizens. Lyle turned to me, fingers outstretched like a coach giving advice on a difficult play.
"So, don't worry. I guess the only thing to remember is to be careful how you talk about Ben. These people can get pretty riled when it comes to him."
"What's pretty riled?"
"Like, do you go to church at all?"
"When I was a kid."
"So, it would be kind of like someone coming into your church and saying they hate God."
It did feel like a church, or maybe a wake. Lots of coffee, dozens of people murmuring in dark wool clothes, regretful smiles. The air was blue with cigarette smoke, and I thought how rarely I saw that anymore after growing up in Diane's foggy trailer. I took a deep breath of it. We'd knocked several times on the open door, and when no one heard, we just walked in. Lyle and I stood there, American Gothic style, for a good 5 seconds as the conversation trailed off and people started staring. An older woman with Brillo wire hair and barrettes blinked at me with the force of someone giving a secret code, a smile frozen large on her face. A brunette in her early 20s, startlingly pretty, looked up from dishing peaches into a baby's mouth, and she too offered an expectant smile. One glaring old broad with a snowman's build tightened her lips and fingered the crucifix on her neck. But everyone else in the room was clearly following orders. Be nice. They were all women, more than a dozen, and they were all white. Most looked careworn, but a handful had the bright, full hour in front of the mirror look of the upper class. That's how you pick 'em, not by the clothes or the cars, but by the extra touches. An antique brooch, rich women always have antique brooches, or lip liner that was blended just the right amount. Probably drove in from Mission Hills, feeling magnanimous about setting foot north of the river. Not a single man there. It was what Diane would call a hen party, and then make that disapproving sinus sound. I wondered how they'd all found Ben, stuck in prison as he was, and what attraction he had for them. Did they sit in their tousled beds at night with their gelatined husband snoring next to them and daydream about a life with Ben once they freed him? Or did they think of him as a poor kid in need of their altruism, a cause to be nurtured between tennis matches? Out of the kitchen stomped Magda, 6 foot tall, her frizzy hair almost as wide. I wouldn't have been able to place her from the Kill Club meeting, where everyone's face was smeared from my memory. A Polaroid, yanked out too early. Magda wore a denim jumper dress over a turtleneck and an incongruous amount of jewelry. Dangly gold earrings, a thick gold chain, and rings on almost every finger but her wedding finger. All those rings unsettled me, like barnacles growing where they shouldn't be. I shook Magda's outstretched hand anyway, warm and dry. She made a sound like, "Ma!" and pulled me in for a hug, her big breasts parting and closing on me like a wave. I stiffened, then pulled away. But Magda held on to my hands.
"Bygones be bygones. Welcome to my home," she said.
"Welcome," called the women behind her, too close to unison. "You are welcome here," Magda reasserted. Well, obviously, since I'd been invited, I wanted to say. "This, everyone, is Libby Day, Ben's youngest sister."
"Ben's only sister," I added. The women nodded solemnly.
"And that's part of the reason we're here today,"
Magda addressed the room.
"To help bring some peace to that situation and help bring Ben home."
I glanced at Lyle, who wrinkled his nose minutely. Beyond the living room,
A boy of about 15, chubby in a less authoritative way than his mother, came down the carpeted stairs. He'd put on khakis and a button-down for the occasion, and he looked out into the room without making any eye contact, one thumb fiddling with the top of his belt. Magda sighted the kid, but didn't introduce him. Instead, she said, "Ned, go in the kitchen and make more coffee." The boy walked through the circle of women without moving his shoulders, staring at a spot on the wall no one else could see. Magda pulled me into the room, me pretending to cough so I could free my hand. She set me down in the middle of the sofa, one woman on each side of me. I don't like sitting in the middle, where arms brush lightly against mine and knees graze my pant leg. I balanced on one buttock and then the other, trying not to sink into the cushion, but I'm so small I still ended up looking like a cartoon kid in an overstuffed chair. "Libby, I'm Katrin. I'm so sorry for your loss," said one of the rich ladies next to me, looking down into my face, her perfume widening my nostrils. "Hi, Catherine." I wondered when the time limit lapsed on expressing sadness for a stranger's dead. I guess never. "It's Katrin," she said with sugar, her gold flower brooch bobbing on its clasp. There's another way to pick rich women. They immediately correct how their names are said. Alicia, not Alicia. Deborah, not Deborah. I said nothing in response. Lyle was talking tightly with an older woman across the room, giving her his profile. I pictured her hot breath tunneling into his tiny snail ear. Everyone kept talking and looking at me, whispering and looking at me. "Well, want to get the show going?" I said, and clapped once. It was rude, but I didn't need the suspense. "Well, Libby, Ned, will you get that coffee out here?" Magda started. "We're here to talk with you about your father, as the prime suspect in the murders your brother has been wrongfully convicted of." "Right, the murders of my family." Magda pulled in an impatient breath, annoyed I would assert my rights to my family. "But before we work on that," Magda continued, "we want to share with you some of our stories about your brother, who we all love." A slender 50-something woman with administrative hair stood up. "My name is Gladys. I met Ben 3 years ago through my charity work," she said. "He changed my life. I write to a lot of prisoners." Here I physically scoffed, and the woman noted it. "I write to prisoners because to me it's the ultimate Christian act, loving the usually unlovable. I'm sure everyone here's seen Dead Man Walking. But I began writing Ben, and the purity of him just shined through his letters. He is true grace under fire, and I love that he's able to make me laugh, when I'm supposed to be helping him about the horrible conditions he endures each day." Everyone added a note then. "He's so funny. That's so true. He's amazing that way." Ned appeared with a coffee pot and started refilling a dozen outstretched plastic mugs, the ladies hand signaling to stop pouring without even looking at him. A younger woman stood up, about Lyle's age, trembling. "I'm Allison. I met Ben through my mom, who couldn't be here today." "Chemo, ovarian cancer," whispered Katrin. "But we both feel the same, which is her work on this earth is not done until Ben is a free man." There were scattered claps at this. "And it's just, here the girl's trembles turned to tears. "He's so good, and it's all so wrong, and I just can't believe we live in a world where someone as good as Ben is in a cage, for no good reason." I set my jaw then. I could feel this going south. "I just think you need to set this all right," spat the crucifixed snow woman, who looked the least friendly. She didn't bother to stand up, just leaned around a few people.
You need to right your wrongs, just like anybody else. And I'm real sorry for the loss of your family, and I'm real sorry for what you've gone through, but now you need to be a grown-up and fix it.
I couldn't spot anyone nodding at that little speech, but the room was full of an agreement so strong it seemed to have a sound. An mm-hmm sound I couldn't trace, like the hum of a railroad track when the train is still miles away but churning toward you. I glanced at Lyle, and he rolled his eyes discreetly. Magda moved to the center of the entryway, swelling like a red-nosed orator on the hustings.
Libby, we have forgiven you for your part in this fiasco. We believe your father committed this horrible crime. We have motive, we have opportunity, we have many important facts, she said, unable to pull up more legal jargon.
Motive. 2 weeks before the murders, your mother, Patricia Day, filed a complaint against your father concerning child support. For the first time, Ronald Runner Day was going to be legally on the hook to his family. He was also in hock several $1,000s for gambling debts. Removing your family from this situation would help his finances tremendously. He was assuming he was still in your mother's will when he went there that night. As it turned out, Ben was not at home when he arrived and you escaped. He killed the others.
I pictured Runner breathing heavily, striding through the house with that shotgun, his grimy Stetson tilted back as he sighted my mother with the 10-gauge. I heard the bellowing in my head that I always heard when I remembered that night, and tried to make it come out of Runner's mouth.
Fibers from your home were found in Runner's cabin, although this has been continually dismissed because he'd been in and out of your home that summer, but it's still a viable fact. None of the victim's blood or tissue was found on Ben, although the prosecution made a lot of the fact that Ben's blood was found in the house.
Hello? Like you aren't allowed to cut yourself shaving? The angry crucifixed woman said.
The women laughed on cue, primed.
Finally, the part that I'm most excited for, Libby, is the opportunity portion. As you know, your father was vouched for by a girlfriend of his at the time, a Ms. Peggy Banion. Just so you know, there's no shame in righting a wrong. Peggy is currently in the process of recanting that alibi, even though she could be sentenced up to 5 years.
Well, she won't be, cheered Katrin. We won't let that happen.
The others applauded as a spindly woman in elasticized jeans stood up. She wore her hair short, the top part permed and frosted, and her eyes were small and bland as dimes that had been in someone's pocketbook too long. She looked at me, then away. She fiddled with the oversized blue stone she wore on a chain, which matched a blue stripe on her sweatshirt. I pictured her at home in front of a water-stained mirror, enjoying the slight bit of good fortune of matching her necklace to the sweatshirt. I stared at my dad's girlfriend, this special guest of Magda's, and willed myself not to blink.
I just want to thank you all for your support these past months, she began, her voice reedy. Runner Day used me like he used everyone. I'm sure you know.
It took a few seconds before I realized she was talking to me. I nodded, then wished I hadn't.
Share your story with us, will you, Peggy? Magda said.
I could tell Magda watched a lot of Oprah. She had the cadence, but not the warmth.
The truth of the story is this. On the evening of January 2nd, I cooked dinner for Runner at his cabin. It was chop suey with rice. And, of course, with Runner, a lot of beer. He drank these beers called Mickey's Big Mouths. You had to pull the tab off. But the tabs came off at these sharp angles, looked like crab claws, and he was always all cut up by them. Do you remember that, Libby? He was always bleeding with those.
What happened after dinner?
Lyle interrupted. I waited for him to look over at me for an appreciative smile, but he didn't.
We had relations. Then Runner was out of beer, so he left to get more beer. I think this was about 8 p.m., because I watched The Fall Guy, although I remember it was a repeat and that was discouraging.
She watched The Fall Guy, Magda piped in. Isn't that ironic?
Peggy looked at her, blankly.
Anyway, Runner left and he didn't come back, and, you know, it's wintertime, so I fell asleep early. I woke up to him coming home, but he didn't have a clock, so I don't know what time it was. But it was definitely middle of the night, definitely late, because I kept waking up, and I finally got up to pee, and the sun was starting to come up, and that couldn't have been more than a few hours later.
When this woman was peeing and looking for toilet paper and probably not finding toilet paper, then wending her way back to bed through the motors and blades and TV intestines that Runner always pretended to be working on, maybe stubbing a toe, feeling sulky, I was crawling through snow toward my blood-soaked house, my family dead. I held it against her.
Lord help me, the police came by in the morning, asking Runner where he was between 12 and 5 a.m., asking me where he was. The whole time he was so insistent. I was home early. I was home way before midnight. And I don't think he was. But I went along with it. I just went along.
Well, you're done with that, girl, said the brunette with the baby.
I haven't even heard from him in a year.
Well, that's more than me, I said, and regretted it. I wondered if this woman would have kept her secret if Runner had just stayed in touch a bit more, phoned every 3 months instead of every 8.
And like I said, Peggy continued, he had these scratches on him, all over his hands, but I can't be sure that it wasn't from those beer taps. I just don't remember if he scratched himself before he left that night, or if maybe someone scratched him.
Only one victim, Michelle Day, was found to have any skin under her nails, which makes sense, since she was strangled, so she was physically closest to the killer, Lyle said.
We all sat quietly for a second, the baby's coos fluttering higher, heading toward squeals.
Unfortunately, that piece of skin was lost somewhere before it reached the laboratory.
I pictured Runner, with that leery, wide-eyed look of his, bearing down on Michelle, the weight of him pushing her into the mattress, and Michelle scrambling to breathe, trying to rip his hands away, getting one good scratch in, a scrawl over the back of his small, oil-stained hands, wrapping themselves more tightly around her neck.
And that's my story,
Peggy said, with an open-handed shrug, a comedian's what-you-gonna-do gesture.
Ned, we're ready for the dessert,
Magda hollered toward the kitchen, and Ned hustled in, shoulders up near his ears, crumbs on his lower lip as he bore a depleted plate of dry cookies with hard jelly centers.
Jesus, Ned, stop eating my stuff, Magda snapped, glowering over the tray.
I just had two.
Bullshit, you had two.
Magda lit a cigarette from a limp pack. Go to the store. I need cigarettes. And more cookies.
Jenna's got the car.
Walk then. It'll be good for you.
The women were clearly planning on making a night of it, but I wasn't going to stay. I parked myself near the door, eyeing a cloisonné candy dish that seemed too nice for Magda. I slipped it into my pocket as I watched Lyle work out the deal. Magda saying, she'll do it. She's got him. Does she actually believe? As she flapped her checkbook. Each time I blinked, Peggy was edging closer to me, some grotesque chess game. Before I could make a break for the bathroom, she was there at my elbow.
You don't look like Runner at all, she said, squinting. Maybe the nose.
I look like my mother. Peggy seemed stricken. You with him a long time? I offered.
Off and on, I guess. Yeah. I mean, I'd have boyfriends in between, but he had a way of coming back and making you feel like it was part of the plan. Like, almost like you'd discussed it, that he'd disappear but come back and it would be the same as it was before. I don't know. I wished I'd met an accountant or something like that.
I never know where to go to meet nice men. In my whole life. I mean, where do you go?
She seemed to be asking for a geographic place, like there was a special town where all the accountants and actuaries were kept. You still in Kinnicky? She nodded. I'd leave there, for a start.
Patty Day, January 2, 1985, 3:10 p.m. Patty flew into the driver's seat of Diane's car, her eyes on the keys dangling from the ignition. Get out of here, now, get out. Diane hopped into the passenger side as Patty turned over the engine. She actually made a burned rubber noise as she squealed away from the Mueller's house, the rear end of the car flailing behind her. All the crap in Diane's trunk, baseballs and garden tools and the girls' dolls, rolled and banged like passengers in a turnover wreck. She and Diane bumped along the gravel road, dust flying, skidding toward the trees on the left and then veering toward a ditch on the right. Finally, Diane's strong hand appeared and landed gently on the wheel. Easy. Patty rumbled along until she got off the Mueller property, swung a wide left, pulled to the side of the road, and cried, fingers grasped around the wheel, her head on the center causing an aborted honk.
What the hell is going on?
She shrieked. It was a child's tear scream, wet, enraged, and baffled. Some strange stuff, Diane said, patting her back. Let's get you home.
I don't want to go home. I need to find my son.
The word son started her weeping again, and she let it rip, gulping sobs and thoughts jabbing her like needles. He'd need a lawyer. They didn't have money for a lawyer. He'd get some bored county guy appointed to him. They'd lose. He'd go to jail. What would she tell the girls? How long did someone go away for something like that? 5 years? 10? She could see a big prison parking lot, the gates opening, and her Ben gingerly walking out, 25 years old, frightened of the open space. Eyes narrowed against the light. He comes near her, her arms open, and he spits on her for not saving him. How do you live with not being able to save your son? Could she send him away, on the run, fugitive? How much money could she even give him? In December, numb from exhaustion, she'd sold her dad's 45 auto to Linda Boyler. She could picture Dave Boyler, who she'd never liked, opening it up Christmas morning, this gun he didn't earn. So Patty right now had almost $300 squirreled away in the house. It was all owed to others. She'd planned on making her first of the month rounds later today. But that wouldn't happen now. Plus, $300 would only keep Ben going a few months.
Ben will come home when he finishes blowing off steam,
Diane reasoned.
How far can he get on a bike in January?
What if they find him first?
Sweetheart, there's no mob after him. You heard, the Mueller boys didn't even know about the accusation. They were talking about other bullshit rumors. We need to talk to Ben to straighten this out. But for all we know, he could be home right now.
Who's the family that's saying he did this?
No one said.
You can find out, though. They can't just say things like that and expect us to lie down and take it, right? You can find out. We have a right to know who's saying this. Ben has a right to confront his accuser. I have a right.
Fine. Let's go back to the house, check in on the girls, and I'll make some calls. Now will you let me drive?
They walked into pure din. Michelle was trying to fry salami strips on the skillet, screaming at Debbie to go away. Libby had a splatter of bright pink burns up one arm and a cheek where the grease had hit her, and was sitting on the floor, mouth wide, crying the way Patty had just been crying in the car, as if there was absolutely no hope. And even if there was, she wasn't up to the challenge. Patty and Diane moved like they were choreographed. One of those German clocks with the fancy men and women dancing in and out. Diane strode to the kitchen in three big steps and yanked Michelle away from the stove, dragging her by the one arm, doll-like, to the living room, depositing her on the sofa with a swat on her tush. Patty crisscrossed them, swooped up Libby, who monkey wrapped herself around her mother and continued crying into her neck. Patty turned on Michelle, who was loosing fat, silent tears. "I told you, you may only use the stove to heat soup. You could have set this whole place on fire." Michelle glanced around the shabby kitchen and living room as if wondering whether that would be a loss. "We were hungry," Michelle mumbled. "You've been gone forever."
"And that means you need a fried salami sandwich your mom told you not to make?"
snapped Diane, finishing up the frying, slapping the meat on a plate.
"She needs you to be good girls right now."
"She always needs us to be good girls," Debbie mumbled.
She was nuzzling a pink stuffed panda that Ben had won years ago at the Cloud County Fair. He'd knocked down a bunch of milk bottles, just as his preteen muscles were coming in. The girls had celebrated as if he'd won a Medal of Honor. The days never won anything. They always said that, marveling, whenever they had a tiny piece of good luck.
"We never win anything."
It was the family motto. "And is it really so hard to be good?" Diane gave Debbie a soft chuck under her chin, and Debbie lowered her gaze even more as she started to smile.
"I guess not."
Diane said she'd make the calls, grabbing the kitchen phone and pulling it all the way down the hall as far as it could go.
As she walked away, she told Patty to feed her dang children, the words riling Patty, as if she was so negligent she often forgot meals. Make tomato soup from ketchup and milk from a powder? Yes.
Toast some stale bread, add a squirt of mustard and call it a sandwich? Yes. On the worst days? Yes. But she never forgot. The kids were on the free lunch program at school, so they always got something there at least. Even as she thought this, she felt worse. Because Patty went to the same school as a kid, and she never had to do the half lunch or free lunch, and now her stomach knotted as she remembered the free lunch kids and her patronizing smiles toward them as they presented their dog-eared cards, and the steamy cafeteria ladies would call it out, "Free lunch!" And the boy next to her, buzz-haired and confident, would whisper inanely, "There's no such thing as a free lunch." And she'd feel sorry for the kids, but not in a way that made her want to help, just in a way that made her not want to look at them anymore. Libby was still heaving and crying in her arms. Patty's neck was sweaty from the girl's hot breaths. After twice asking Libby to look at her, the girl finally blinked and turned her face up to her mother's.
"I got burned."
Then she started crying again.
"Baby, baby, it's just a few ouchies. It won't be permanent. Is that what you're worried about? They're just some little pink ouchies. You won't even remember next week."
"Something bad's gonna happen."
Libby was her worrier. She came out of the womb wary and stayed that way. She was the nightmare girl, the fretter. She was an out-of-nowhere pregnancy. Neither Patty nor Runner were happy. They didn't even bother with a baby shower. Their families were so sick of them procreating that the entire pregnancy was an embarrassment. Libby must have marinated in anxious stomach acid for 9 months, soaking up all that worry. Potty training her was surreal. She screamed when she saw what came out of her, ran away naked and frantic. Dropping her off at school had always been an act of utter abandonment. Her daughter with the giant wet eyes, face pressed against the glass, as a kindergarten teacher restrained her. This past summer she refused to eat for a week, turned white and haunted, and then finally, revealed to Patty a pot of warts that had sprouted on one knee.
Eyes down in slow sentences that Patty extracted from her over the course of an hour, Libby explained that she thought the warts might be like poison ivy, that they'd eventually cover her and, sob, no one would be able to see her face anymore. And when Patty had asked why in the world hadn't Libby told her these worries before, Libby just looked at her like she was crazy. Whenever possible, Libby prophesied doom. Patty knew that, but the words still made her clench. Something bad had already happened, but it would get worse.
She sat with Libby on the couch, smoothing her hair, patting her back. Debbie and Michelle hovered near, fetching tissues for Libby and fussing over her the way they should have done a good hour ago. Debbie tried to make the panda pretend talk to Libby, telling her she was okay, but Libby shoved it away and turned her head. Michelle asked if she could cook everyone soup. They ate soup all through the winter, Patty keeping giant vats of it in the freezer locker in the garage. They usually ran out right around the end of February. February was the worst month. Michelle was dumping a big frozen square of beef and vegetables into a stew pot, cracking off the ice, ignoring the plate of salami, when Diane returned with her mouth tugged into a grimace. She lit a cigarette. "Trust me, I need it," and sat down on the sofa, her weight bumping up Patty and Libby like a seesaw. She sent the girls into the kitchen with Michelle, the kids not saying anything, obedient in their nervousness. "Okay, so it's this family named Cates that started it. They live halfway between here and Salina. Send their kid to Kinnicky because the public school's not finished in their suburb. So it started because Ben was doing after-school volunteering with the Cates girl. Did you know he was volunteering?" Patty shook her head. "Volunteering?" Diane pushed her lips out. Didn't jive with her either. "Well, for whatever reason, he was volunteering with these young kids in the elementary school, and this girl's parents say something wrong went on between them. And so do some others. The Hinkles, the Putches, and the Cahills."
"What?"
"They're all comparing notes. They've all talked to the school. From what I hear, the police are involved, and you should expect someone, a cop, to come by today to talk to you and Ben. It's reached that stage. Not everyone at school knows. We're lucky this happened on Christmas break. But I guess after today that won't be the case. I guess any kid who Ben helped after school, the school is talking to the parents. So, like, 10 families.
"What should I do?"
Patty put her head between her knees. She felt laughter in her stomach. It was all so ludicrous.
"I wonder if I'm having a breakdown," she thought.
"Maybe I could have a breakdown and then I won't have to talk to anyone." A safe white room, and Patty being ushered like a child from breakfast to lunch to dinner, maneuvered by people with gentle whispers, Patty shuffling like someone who's dying.
"I guess everyone's over at the Cates place, talking right now," Diane said. "I got the address."
Patty just stared.
"I think we should go over there," Diane said.
"Go over there? I thought you said someone would come here."
"The phone's been ringing off the hook,"
Michelle said. Michelle, who'd been in the kitchen and shouldn't have heard any of this. Patty and Diane both turned to the phone, waiting for it to go off.
"Well, why didn't you answer it like we asked, Michelle?"
Diane said. Michelle shrugged.
"I forgot if we were supposed to or not."
"Maybe we should wait here," Patty said.
"Patty, those families are over there talking shit about your son. Now who knows what kernel of truth may be in there or not. But don't you want to go speak for him? Don't you want to hear what they're saying? Make them say it to our face?"
No, she didn't. She wanted the stories to go away, nice and quiet, creep back into oblivion. She didn't want to hear what people in her town, Maggie Hinkle went to high school with her for Pete's sake, were saying about Ben. And she was afraid she'd crumble with all those furious faces on her. She'd weep, beg for forgiveness. Already, all she wanted was forgiveness. And they hadn't even done anything wrong. Let me put on some better clothes. She found a sweater without rips in the armpits and a pair of khaki slacks. She ran a comb through her hair and exchanged her gold studs for a pair of imitation pearl earrings and matching necklace. You really couldn't tell they were fake. They even felt heavy. As she and Diane went toward the front door, further admonishments about using the stove, a request to turn off the TV and do chores at some point, Libby began wailing again, running toward them with her arms flapping. Michelle crossed her arms over her stained sweatshirt and stomped a foot.
"I can't deal with her when she's like this," she said in a perfect imitation of Patty. "She's too much. It's too much for me."
Patty took a breath in, thought about reasoning with Michelle, thought about bullying Michelle. But Libby was bawling louder, a howling animal, screaming,
"I want to go with you, I want to go with you."
Michelle arching an eyebrow. Patty pictured a cop showing up here while she was away, a burnt-faced, weeping child lying inconsolable on the floor. Should she take all three then? But someone should be here to answer the phone, to be here. And it was probably better to have both Michelle and Debbie here than...
"Libby, go put on your boots," Diane ordered. "Michelle, you are in charge. Answer the phone, don't answer the door. If it's Ben, he'll have a key. If it's someone else, we don't want you two worrying about it. Michelle."
"What's going on?"
"Michelle, I'm not messing with you. Michelle."
"Okay."
"Okay," Diane said. And that, literally, was the final word.
Patty stood in the hallway, useless, watching Libby put on her boots and a pair of dirt-caked mittens. Patty grabbed one woolly hand and walked her toward the car. It might be good, anyway, if people were reminded Ben had little sisters who loved him. Libby wasn't a big talker. Michelle and Debbie seemed to hog all her words. She made pronouncements. "I like ponies. I hate spaghetti. I hate you." Like her mother, she had no poker face, no poker mood. It was all right there. When she wasn't angry or sad, she just didn't say much. Now, seat-belted in back, taken along for the ride, she sat silently, her pink blotched face aimed out the window, a finger against the glass, tracing the tops of trees outside. Neither Patty nor Diane spoke either, and the radio stayed off. Patty tried to picture the visit. Visit? Could you really call something this repulsive a visit? But all she could see was her screaming, "Leave my son alone!" She and Maggie Hinkle had never been friends, but they'd always exchanged conversation at the grocery store, and the Putches she knew from church. These weren't unkind people. They wouldn't be unkind to her. As for the parents of the first girl, Chrissy Cates, Patty had no idea. She pictured the Cateses as brightly blonde and preppy, with everything matching and the house pristine and smelling of potpourri. She wondered if Mrs. Cates would spot the fake pearls. Diane guided her off the highway and into the neighborhood, past a big blue sign boasting of model units and Elkwood Park. So far, it was just blocks and blocks of wooden skeletons, each one an outline of a house, each one allowing you to see the outline of the one next to it and the outline of the one next to that. A teenage girl sat smoking on the second floor of one skeleton house. She looked like Wonder Woman in her invisible plane, sitting in the outlines of a bedroom. When she tapped her cigarette, The ashes fluttered down into the dining room. All the pre-houses unnerved Patty. They were recognizable, but totally foreign. An everyday word you suddenly couldn't remember to save your life.
Pretty, huh?
Diane said, wagging a finger at the neighborhood. Two more turns, and they were there. A block of tidy houses, real houses. A cluster of cars in front of one.
Looks like a party,
Diane sniffed. She rolled down the window and spat outside. The car was silent for a few seconds, except for Diane's throat noises.
Solidarity, Diane said. Don't worry. Worst they can do is yell.
Maybe you should stay here with Libby, Patty said. I don't want yelling in front of her.
Nah, Diane said. No one stays in the car. We can do this. Yeah, Libby? You're a tough little girl, right?
Diane turned her bulk to Libby in the back seat, her parka rustling, and then back to Patty.
It'll be good for them to see her. Know he's got a little sister around who loves him.
Patty had a shot of confidence that she'd thought the same thing. Diane was out of the car then, on the other side, rousting Libby, and opening the door wide for her to get out. The three of them walked up the sidewalk, Patty immediately feeling ill. Her ulcers had been quiet for a bit, but now her belly burned. She had to unclench her jaw and work it loose. They stood on the doorstep, Patty and Diane in front, with Libby just behind her mother, glancing out backward. Patty imagined a stranger driving past, thinking they were friends joining the festivities. The door still had a Christmas wreath on it. Patty thought, they had a nice, happy Christmas, and now they are frightened and angry. And I bet they keep thinking, but we just had such a nice, happy Christmas.
The house was like something from a catalog, and there were two BMWs in the driveway, and these were not people who were used to bad things happening.
I don't want to do this. I don't think we should do this, she blurted.
Diane rang the doorbell and gave her a look straight from their dad, the calm, unmoved look he gave whiners. Then she said exactly what Dad always said when he gave the look. Nothing to it but to do it. Mrs. Cates answered the door, blonde and prairie-faced. Her eyes were red from crying, and she was holding a tissue.
Hello. May I help you? Are you Chrissy Cates' mother?
Patty started and began crying.
I am,
the woman said, fingers on her own pearls, her eyes shifting back and forth to Patty and Diane, and then down to Libby.
Oh, was your little girl? Did he hurt your little girl, too?
No,
Patty said.
I'm Ben's mother. I'm Ben Day's mother.
She wiped the tears with the back of her hand, then with the sleeve of her sweater.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Oh, Lou! Come here. Hurry.
Mrs. Cates's voice grew loud and quivery, the sound of an airplane going down. Several faces Patty didn't recognize peered around the corner of the living room. A man walked past from the kitchen holding a tray of sodas. One girl lingered in the hallway, a pretty blonde girl wearing flowered jeans.
Who's that?
The girl chirped.
Go get your father.
Mrs. Cates moved to fill up the doorway, almost physically pushing them from the doorstep.
Lou!
She called back into the house. A man appeared behind her, slab-like, 6'5" at least, solid, with a way of keeping his chin up that reminded Patty of people who got what they wanted.
This is her. This is Ben Day's mother,
the woman said with such disgust Patty could feel her womb flinch.
You'd better come inside,
the man said. And when Patty and Diane glanced at each other, he snapped,
Come, come.
Like they were bad pets. They stepped into the home, into a sunken den, and peered out on a scene that looked like a children's birthday party. Four girls were in various states of play. They wore foil stars on their faces and hands, the kind of stickers teachers used to mark good grades. Several were sitting with their parents, eating cake, the girls looking greedy, the moms and dads looking panicked behind brave faces. Chrissy Cates had plopped herself in the middle of the floor and was playing dolls with a large, dark-haired young man who sat cross-legged in front of her, ingratiating himself. They were those spongy, unpretty dolls Patty had seen in movies of the week, with Meredith Baxter Burney or Patty Duke Aston as determined mothers or lawyers. They were the dolls that kids used to show how they were abused. Chrissy had stripped the clothes off both dolls and was placing the boy doll on top of the girl doll. She bumped it up and down and chanted nonsense words. A brunette girl watched from her mother's lap while eating icing from under her fingernails. She seemed too old to be in her mother's lap. Like that, Chrissy concluded, bored or angry, and tossed the doll aside. The young man, a therapist, a social worker, someone who wore Shetland sweaters with plaid shirts underneath, someone who went to college, picked the doll back up and tried to get Chrissy's attention. Chrissy, let's, he said, holding the boy doll carefully off one knee, the doll's penis drooping toward the floor. Who is that? Chrissy said, pointing at Patty. Patty strode across the room, ignoring all the parents, who began standing, wavering like strummed wires. Chrissy, she said, crouching down on the floor. My name is Patty. I'm Ben Day's mom. Chrissy's eyes widened, her lips quivered, and she scooted away from Patty. There was a second of silence, like a slow-motion crash, where she and Patty stared at each other. Then Chrissy tilted her head back and yelled, I don't want her here! Her voice echoed off the skylight. I don't want her here! You said I wouldn't have to! She threw herself on the floor and began ripping at her hair. The brunette girl ran over and wrapped herself over Chrissy, wailing, I don't feel safe. Patty stood up, spinning around the room, saw parents with frightened, revolted faces, saw Diane hustling Libby behind her toward the door. We've heard about you, Chrissy Cates's mother said, her sweet, drained face twisted into a ball. She motioned back to Maggie Hinkle, Patty's old classmate, who blushed at Patty. You've got four kids at home, she continued, her voice tight, her eyes wet. You can't afford a one of them. Their daddy's a drunk. You're on welfare. You leave your girls alone with that jackal. You let your son prey on girls. Jesus Christ, you've let your son do this. God knows what happens out there. The Putsch girl stood and screamed then, tears rolling past bright stars on her cheeks. She joined the pack in the middle, where the young man was murmuring soothing words, trying to maintain eye contact with them. I don't want them here, Chrissy yelled again. Where's Ben, Patty? Maggie Hinkle said, her spade-faced daughter sitting beside her, expressionless. The police really need to talk to Ben. I hope you're not hiding him. Me? I've been trying to find him. I'm trying to straighten this out. Please. Please help me. Please forgive me. Please stop screaming. Maggie Hinkle's daughter remained quiet, then tugged at her mother's sleeve. Mom, I want to leave. The other girls continued to howl, watching each other. Patty stood, looking down at Chrissy and the therapist, who was still cradling the naked doll boy that was supposed to be Ben. Her stomach seized, flushed her throat with acid.
I think you should leave,
snapped Mrs. Cates, picking up her daughter like a toddler, the girl's legs dangling almost to the floor, Mrs. Cates wobbling with the weight. The young therapist stood up, inserting himself between Patty and Mrs. Cates. He almost put a hand on Patty, then moved it to Mrs. Cates instead. Diane was calling from the door, calling Patty's name, or Patty wouldn't have known to move. She was waiting for them to close in on her, scratch her eyes out.
"I'm sorry. I'm sorry,"
Patty was yelling into the room, frantic and dizzy.
"It's a mistake. I'm so sorry."
Then Lou Cates was in front of her, grabbing her by the arm as if he hadn't just invited her in, and walking her toward the door, the keening of four girls behind her. Mothers and dads were everywhere, grown-ups taking care of their children. And Patty felt stupid, not foolish, not embarrassed, unforgivably stupid. She could hear the parents cooing things to their daughters. "Good girl. It's okay, it's okay. She's leaving now. You're safe. We'll make this all better. Hush, hush, baby." Just before Lou Cates propelled her from the room, Patty turned around to see Chrissy Cates in her mother's arms, her blonde hair over one eye. The girl looked at her and said simply, "Ben is going to hell."
Libby Day, now. I'd been commissioned to find Runner, but all my feverish, ambitious action of the past week was slopped on the floor next to my bed like a soiled nightgown. I couldn't get up, even when I heard the kids make their sleepy duck walk past my house. I pictured them in big rubber rain boots, clomping along, leaving rounded footprints in the March muck, and I still couldn't move. I'd woken up from a miserable dream, the kind you keep telling yourself doesn't mean anything, shouldn't bother you, because it's just a dream, just a dream. It started back at the farm, but it wasn't the farm, really. It was far too bright, too tidy to be the farm, but it was, and in the distance, against an orange horizon, Runner was galloping toward the farm, hooting like an Old West cowboy. As he got closer, down our hill, through the gate, I saw that his gallop was actually a rickety bump-along motion, because his horse had wheels. Its top half was flesh, but the bottom was metal, spindly, like a hospital gurney. The horse whinnied at me in panic, its muscled neck trying to separate from the metal below. Runner leapt down, the creature rolling away, one wheel busted, an irritating grocery cart of an animal. It came to a stop near a tree stump, its eyes going white, still struggling to pull itself apart.
"Don't worry about that," Runner grinned at the horse. "I paid for it."
"You got a bad deal," I said. Runner's jaw tightened and he stood too close to me.
"Your mom says it's fine," he muttered.
"That's right," I thought. "My mom is alive." The idea felt solid, like a pebble in my pocket. My mom was alive, and how foolish I'd been all these years thinking otherwise.
"You'd better fix your hand first," Runner said,
pointing at my stumped ring finger.
"I brought you these. Hope you like them better than the horse."
He held up a flimsy velvet bag, the kind used for Scrabble, and shook it. "Oh, I love the horse," I said, batting away my ill will. The horse had torn its hindquarters from the metal and was bleeding a meaty red oil onto the ground. From his bag, Runner poured 8 or 9 fingers. Every time I picked one that looked like mine, I realized it was a pinky finger, a man's finger, a finger of the wrong color or size. Runner was pursing his lips at me.
"Just take one, okay? It's not a big deal."
I picked one that was vaguely similar to my lost one, and Runner sewed it to my hand, the ripped horse screaming now behind us, A woman's scream, terrified and angry. Runner threw a shovel at it, and it broke in two, pulsing on the ground, unable to move.
There, Runner said with a lip smack. Good as new.
Between my two girlish fingers, a bulbous big toe squatted, tied on with lazy, thick stitches. And suddenly, Runner's girlfriend Peggy was there and said, Honey, your mom is not here, remember? We killed her. And Runner smacked his head like a man who'd forgotten to bring home milk and said,
That's right, that's right. I got all them girls, except Libby.
We three stood blinking at each other, the air turning nasty. Then Runner went back to the horse and picked up the shovel, which had become an axe. I flung myself awake, one arm cracking my bedside lamp to the floor. It was barely dawn when I turned and watched the glowing lamp on its side, wondered if the light bulb would burn a hole in the carpet. Now it was morning, and still I couldn't move. But the light was on in Ben's room. My first real thought. That night the light was on in Ben's room, and someone was talking. I wanted to stop thinking about it, but I always came back to it. Why would a crazed killer go into Ben's room, close the door, turn on the light, and chat? The light was on in Ben's room. Forget the other stuff. A vengeful Lou Cates, a debt-crazed Runner, a pack of goons who wanted to teach Runner a lesson by murdering his family. Forget the bellowing voice I heard, which, fine, I guess, may not have been Ben's. But he wasn't home when we went to bed, and when I woke up, the light was on. I remember a flush of relief because Ben was home, because his light was on, and the fight was over between him and my mom, at least for today, because the light was on, and he was talking behind the door, maybe on his new phone, or to himself, but the light was on. And who was Deandra? I prepared to get out of bed, tossing the covers aside, the sheets dank-smelling, gray from my body. I wondered how long it had been since I'd changed them. And then I wondered how often you were supposed to change them. These were the kinds of things you didn't learn. I changed the bedclothes after sex now, finally, and that I only learned a few years ago from a movie on TV. Glenn Close, some thriller, and she's just had sex and is changing the sheets, and I can't remember the rest, because all I was thinking was, oh, I guess people change sheets after they have sex. It made sense, but I'd never thought of it. I was raised feral, and I mostly stayed that way. I got out of bed, finally returning the lamp to my bed table, and walked roundabout to the living room, sneaking up on the answering machine, not letting it know I cared if it had a message. I might as well have whistled, my feet kicking out ahead of me. Nothing unusual here, just out for a walk. No Diane. 4 days, and no Diane. Well, no problem. I had other family. Ben was waiting for me this time when I came, sliding into view before I was prepared. He sat rigid in the seat behind glass, his eyes unfocused, a jumpsuited mannequin. I wanted to tell him not to do that to me. It gave me the creeps. But I didn't say anything, because why would he give me the creeps, unless I still didn't entirely believe he was innocent? Which I didn't, I guess. I sat down, the chair still humid from someone else, the warmth of the plastic feeling grossly intimate in this place. I mushed my buttocks back and forth, making it mine, trying not to look repulsed. But when I picked up the phone, it was still sweaty from the previous user, and whatever look I gave made Ben frown.
You okay?
He asked, and I nodded once. Yes, sure, absolutely fine.
So you came back,
he said. He fixed on a smile now, cautious, the way Ben always was. At a family party on the last day of school, he looked the same. A kid who lived permanently in the library, waiting to be shushed. I came back. He had a nice face. Not handsome, but nice. The face of a good guy. Catching me assessing him, his eyes darted to